Oh, hi. Time for Mac Break Weekly episode 500. Alex, Renee, and Andy are here, and we'll celebrate and shoot this whole thing in 360-degree video next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Mac Break Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 500, recorded Tuesday, March 29th, 2016. 85 Alexes. Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by Drobo, a family of safe, expandable, and easy-to-use storage arrays. Drobos are designed to protect your important data forever. Visit drobo.com/twit and use a code TWIT100 to save $100 off a Drobo Mini, 5D, 5N, or the new Drobo B810i. And by Atlassian. Unleash your team's potential with collaborative software tools like HipChat and Jira. It'll enable you to work and communicate better together. Visit Atlassian.com to learn more. And by Texture, the mobile app that lets you access the world's most popular magazines anytime, anywhere, using your phone or tablet. For your free trial, visit Texture.com/MacBreak. It's time for Mac Break Weekly, episode 500. And we got a great cast assembled. The Mac Break Weekly stalwarts, Andy and Notko from the Chicago Sun-Times. With a beautiful view. I mean, that shot is excellent now, Andy. You've just stepped up your game big time.
Unfortunately, now I've got to actually sound like I know what I'm talking about, because now I look like I
look like
a professional something.
You look better than me, which is not I'm not happy about. But there you go. And Alex Lindsay, man, he always looks so real, so realistic, even though we've keyed him into the shot
I've improved the connection a little bit.
He's in Rwanda right now.
No, yeah, exactly.
He's not. He's right here. From Pixel Core. If you were in Rwanda, could I be...
It takes some work to do that, to make that work.
Also from, is it Winnipeg this time, it looks like? Renee Ritchie?
Yeah, I'm in Winnipeg again, Leo. But it's episode 500, so I don't care where I am as long as I'm here.
I'm so glad you're here. iMore.com. And a special visitor for episode 500, a visitor from the East, the Far East, from Finland. We have an Ozo on the set.
Yeah, we're looking at the next 500 episodes, and this might be hopefully part of it. This is the new Nokia Ozo. We're testing it right now.
Now wait a minute. Now, this is a VR 360-degree VR camera.
That's right.
That, as I remember, cost $60,000.
Yes.
And how many cameras?
Not as much as one Tesla.
It's, well, we already figured out. I think it's, 150 Alexes. But
I think it's only 85 Alexes. I think it's not quite 150 Alexes.
Well under two digits.
Yeah, exactly. So
how many cameras on that thing? Tell us a little bit about it.
So there's 8 cameras, and what they're doing is that they actually, you'll notice that the cameras, you're getting kind of the back of it from that angle, but the cameras are about the same distance between each other as your eyes. So it's able to use that to help build a stereo pair. Now, you can either do it in what we would call mono or stereo, depending on how you what you grab and how you stitch it. And so what's nice about it is this is the first one that's kind of simple and straightforward to use. I mean, I know it's expensive, but the big thing for us is that it is, when you think about production, It just works. I've got a single SDI feed out the back of it that carries all the data, and it gives it. It's their own proprietary encoding, so it comes out of that, and it just looks like.
So I'm looking on the screen on the Nokia site, and it looks like 8 fisheye images, and those will then be stitched together by. They have their own software, I presume.
Yes. They have that, and you can also use these. Can be exported out as individual feeds.
Oh, there's our feed.
Yeah, there's our feed, and that's what it looks like when you're shooting.
Now, if you're watching this video on the Ozo, and you're seeing that, you're really confused at this point. So if you're watching on the Ozo, you can actually, and we're going to post this.
Yeah,
we're going to post this, but you can actually look around. You can look behind you, see our studio audience, all two of them. You can see Jason, our technical director, in the back waving.
Nobody pick your nose. You are never not on camera.
Everybody's on camera.
Everybody is. This is spectacular. I mean, this is my dream, is to have this in the studio. You can't stream live with it yet.
Not yet.
Because the horsepower to stitch it, which you tell me is currently takes 4 hours to do 1 minute.
Now the thing is that we're doing a lot of post-processing that makes it a lot better than even live will be. So we stream live now.
Is it HD quality for the final?
It'll actually be 4K.
4K.
Because the problem is you have to remember that when you look in your goggles, you're looking at only a small piece of a big sphere. So if it's less than 4K, it gets pretty soft. Now, when you're previewing it, like right now, if someone put on the goggles over there, we've got the DK2 over there. And if you put those goggles on, you can actually watch it live.
Oh, so you can stream that live.
And what it's doing is it's actually switching between the cameras really, really carefully so that you might see it pop every once in a while, but that gives you a raw feed.
Right.
So you can look at the raw feed, and that's good for previewing and so on and so forth. And the live feed is stitched. Now, the other cool thing is it's got lots of little mics on it, so it's actually able to do 5.1 surround sound.
See, this is a huge part of it that I think we're a little bit missing in the current generation of VR gear, is that you don't have that amazing sound.
Right.
Should match the image.
And this is built for that, so you'll see those little mics there.
How would you view that? I mean, people can watch this on a 2D screen on YouTube. Some of you are doing that. Or with cardboard, and then you can look around, or a Gear VR. If you had an Oculus Rift, you'd have stereo sound, but
you could. Yeah.
Yeah, but you wouldn't have, like, my head turns and I'll hear what's over. It wouldn't shift with my head.
Not yet. But a lot of people are working on that.
Yeah, of course.
You know, so that's knowing where that is and knowing where that sound is something that
is kind of future-proofing, because this is like state of the art. And the art's not there. And the viewing art. And this is like you when you shot a 1080p.
I know.
The first 1080p podcast.
I had to get out on that front edge, you know. So that's what we've done, for 15 years. And so we build our own rigs. So we've got, we've got GoPro rigs. We've got Blackmagic rigs.
You could gaff tape, eight GoPros together.
Exactly. But the problem really gets into is when you actually want to do production with it. So I actually want to do this regularly. I want to be able to go to a set and just have it work.
Yeah.
This is the kind of camera you're looking for when you just want to go there and have it work. And I think that, that's the kind of thing that we're trying to solve. And so, so we're testing it right now, and we've only had it for a couple of days, but we're pretty excited about it.
This is really, thank you so much for bringing this along. We're going to, if you want to see the output of this, we'll put it up on YouTube, and you'll be able to download it from our feed. If you have a Gear VR, you could watch it that way, or put it on your phone and use Google Cardboard. But the easiest would be probably right on the Twit specials feed. We'll put it on youtube.com/Twit and youtube.com/Twit specials, and you can watch it there. This will be a special kind of 2-minute version because, let's see, we're 6 minutes in, so this is going to take a day just to render.
Currently, in the current technology,
but that's how 1080p works.
Yeah, exactly. 1080p. Yeah. We it took us 3 months to get the first 1080p, or 2 months to put the first 1080p. I had to release a whole episode of the road to 1080p just to stall.
I know.
So because I didn't have anything else to put out, and this is the way it always begins.
Well, thank you so much for letting us sample this. You can great way to celebrate our first 500 episodes of MacBreak Weekly and look ahead to the next 500. So thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so you can cut there, and we'll make that into a little mini thing. And then if you want to talk more about it on your pick, you can. And availability and stuff like that. Wow.
We have a preview of our comment we're going to be making in show 1000. And to think that today we can do that on our phones.
Well, look how fast this happens. I mean, how long ago was the first Mac break? 10 years ago, I guess.
Yeah.
And you had a Lucas... The camera that Lucas used as a model camera.
It was used for a lot of the green screen and everything else. We had a couple of those cameras. No, these were the F950s.
F950s. And that's what episode 3 was shot in the F950, wasn't it?
Episode 3, yep.
Yeah.
And so we had those cameras actually that were used in episode 3. And so it's still working. You know that one's still.
You made a podcast that you could barely edit and no one could watch, because I remember on computers of that day, you couldn't watch it smoothly.
Right.
I mean, we've done it again. You've done it again.
It's my job.
Thank you. That's so cool. Those Cine Altas were okay. So that was 10 years ago, and those Cine Altas were more expensive.
Yeah,
and
each one was about, and I bought them used.
Yeah,
so new they were about $250,000 each.
Right. So four times more expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And the workflow didn't take more than a few years to get to the point where it was trivial to do 1080p workflow.
Yeah, it took us about 6 months. You know, like before we got it working. I mean, it was, but we had to build. We had huge RAIDs, and now this little Drobo that you have there is faster. I mean, I could actually edit off of, I could capture to that, you know.
But that's the point. This stuff is coming along it's accelerating. It's not even, you can't even say it's going to be as fast as that was. It will be much faster.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's just all accelerating.
Well, and the other thing is, this is, the technology is about to explode. I mean, people are spending so much money. Like, this is great right now. We go to NAB in a couple weeks. There's going to be a whole bunch of new toys, a whole bunch of new software. Everyone's talking about it right now. So
we'll be broadcasting live from NAB, by the way. We're going to be in the Ustream, live view booth. I'll be there one day, but the rest of the team will be there all week, and we'll definitely be covering VR. VR is the next. We're getting our Oculus Rift this week. We're going to be we're going to be turning on the ultimate VR gaming machine, the $5,000 computer we built. You know, you saw it. I don't know if you saw Palmer Luckey flew to Alaska to deliver the first Oculus Rift. The guy didn't even have a computer he could plug it into because, you know, only 18% of all the Windows machines in the world are powerful enough today to run that thing.
Right.
So this is what happens. This is, you get on the cutting edge. But I'm really glad that we could put out at least that four minute video so people could get an experience of what, you know, in a few years. And I'd love to hear feedback. Is this one version of the show that or all the shows that we should put out? We're designing the new studio, we're being very cognizant of the fact that it'll be eventually a 360 space.
Right.
So we know where we will put the Ozo and we know how we will use it. You're already thinking about that as you build.
Serious question. Are you actually considering that we want to make this new studio as forward thinking as possible? Are you actually contemplating having actual blinds in there, like a place where there's no camera that can possibly hit this section of the set, to the extent of even putting up walls that go from floor to ceiling?
The set will be partly for that reason fully enclosed, unlike this set. I always like the idea of having an open set. The rest of the staff hates it, so they can't make noise. They think, I don't care if they make noise, but others might, and so they have to walk around tiptoes and stuff. And so the open set idea really didn't work. So what we're doing this time is it's an enclosed set with all of these sets in it.
Right.
In fact, if you go downstairs in the basement, you can see we've marked it out on the basement, and it's as spacious as this, but it is enclosed. Once you're in that space, though, Andy. There's nowhere private. I guess you could crawl down underneath the TD desk and you could be okay.
You need to put a raised floor that people can crawl under that have little things that pop up. So they can just crawl up under the table and pop up like little gopher holes.
So the code name for this space is going to be North Korea. There is no place under which you are not under surveillance.
Or the Panopticon, maybe we'll call it. Colleen Henry, our first engineer, wanted to build a UV hat that would have invisible, very bright ultraviolet light that would blind cameras. So you could walk, you could put the hat on and walk into the studio and look, you just look like a ball of light. Maybe we'll do that.
Colleen's kind of like a ball of light. I don't think she barely needs the LEDs. You know, there's so much energy and so much. Yeah, I send people over every once in a while to work with her on some stuff, and then they come back and they're like, oh, I have a headache. You know, trying to keep up.
Anyway. Amazing. I watched the other night a movie, Keanu Reeves was the host, but it wasn't written by him. And he interviews all these directors. It came out in 2012 about the conversion from film to digital,
right?
Which was, it was called Side by Side. Highly recommended, even though it's out of date because it's 4 years old now.
Right.
At that time they're saying,
they were thinking about it.
David Fincher is saying things like, you know, it's not too long before most movies are going to be all, you know, shot all on digital. Last year, about 100 films were shot on film.
Yeah.
The rest were shot on film.
Well, you know, and they had to actually, last year, the studios had to dump money into keep the film being made. You know, Kodak was like, okay, we're done.
Yeah.
You know, like, it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't financially make any sense anymore. And now, so the film, there were a handful of people and companies that still wanted to shoot on film. And, you know, they put off the inevitable, which is that, you know, they're going to keep film for a little while longer. But, you know, distribution is gone. You know, you're... They don't. The theaters now don't you know, really want to have. And distribution makes way more sense because now what happens is the every play is being able to be managed. So it used to be film. You don't know how many times the theater
Well, they would
it.
Say that. They'd say
and now
that
they now they know. They have a counter. Lucas, they know exactly.
George Lucas is interviewed on. He said, you know, we'd make the movie and we'd know what it looked like in our offices, but we'd know that it would look different in every single theater and it would get worse over time.
Well,
because you can't control how bright the projectionist is, you know, use what the lamp is, any of that.
Well,
stuff.
and the penny pinchers, what they want to know is how many times was it played? So did they add, did the small theater with film, they could add two or three more showings a day and make a little extra money without reporting it.
Right.
Whereas the
digital,
for the digital, every time you play, because the theater doesn't own the projector.
Right.
The, you know, the distribution owns the projector.
Well,
you know,
the cost of putting film, of not just printing it, but putting them on a truck and shipping it.
$1,500 a reel.
Yeah.
So you're talking about like Harry Potter costs about $7 or $8 million just to put it in the theaters on the first one.
Yeah.
And now it's just, you know, it's a drive.
James Cameron's talking about Titanic. He says, we didn't expect it, but that movie lasted in theaters so long that the film was literally falling apart on the projector.
Well, and then the other thing that you could get away with in the early days was that, or in film days, was that you could be out of focus. You know, focusing in all fairness, focus pulling or keeping the camera in focus is so hard that you really have specialists to do this. And even then, people are moving, the camera's moving, all these other things. Generally, when you're watching something in the theater, you were watching the fourth or fifth generation of the film. You know, they'd have the master, then they'd cut a couple masters, then they'd cut a couple more, and then because otherwise you don't want to use up your master running it over and over again to build these films. And so anyway, you're looking at third, fourth, fifth generation that's going to the theaters, and it softens every single time. So we were kind of used to watching things that are kind of, even if it was out of focus, it looked fine. Like it just everything looked a little soft. And now when things are out of focus, whether you're watching at home on your 70-inch, you know, TV or on the film, you can really tell that, they were a little off there. They got the ears and not the nose and they got the, you know, whatever it was. You know, those things all become much more difficult.
It was going to be my pick, but I'll find something else. But it was a really interesting movie, as dated as it was. For instance, they're talking to Fincher about The Social Network, which was shot on Reds. I think it was the first movie on Red Epic.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, they talk about the development of the Red, and because I guess Panavision had done a digital camera that they were so tied to the past that they actually had a film magazine with the memory in it that they would put on the digital camera, and you couldn't play it back from the film magazine. They said, no, that's the digital negative. You can't do dailies with that. Sorry. So it was a flop, but then along comes Red and they say, we're not going to try to make it look like a Panavision.
Well, and they changed the price dramatically.
So Fincher's saying we had to figure out a way to get this epic on these little tiny crew boats on rowing down the Harvard rowing team with the Winklevi twins on it. And it was so heavy that it would tip the boat. So they went back to Red and they said, what can you do? And Red said, okay, we'll get back to you. 2 days later, they said, yeah, so we figured out carbon fiber. We bored out the inside. Oh, great. When can you get it? Well, I've got one on my desk right now. We'll have it out for you. And they made it like 12 pounds so that they could put it on the boat. I mean, it's a complete revolution. And Andy, I know you recommended a really wonderful book about Hollywood where they talked about how the film changed in the 70s because these cameras went from being so big you had to shoot in a studio to small enough that you could shoot on location. And movies like Bonnie and Clyde and McCabe and Mrs. Miller happened because you could go into the location and shoot. And this is an equivalent revolution, you know. I mean, it's an amazing.
Yeah, the Easy Riders, Raging Bulls,
yeah,
I think.
That was a great book, by the way.
Yeah, it's because it's not as though these were the only movies that in the 70s, the only movies that were ever shot that way. But there's a reason why in Saturday Night Fever, you have this shot that follows John Travolta off of a street in Brooklyn into a paint store. And you can actually see, like, the ceiling of the paint store. That's because just 10 years earlier, the only way to get that shot would have been to build a set off of an actual street that was rigged for lighting, whereas you can just simply take a camera, put a guy in a shopping cart even, and just roll them from one place. So the French Connection is another great example of that. So the technology really informs what it suddenly makes things possible that were once only imaginary.
Well, and you look at the, like, a Blackmagic micro studio camera, you know, is 4K, micro four thirds, $1,200, $1,300. And you know, we buy them like little chiclets because you can make VR rigs. You can, you know, put them up over top of things, and you can, you know, you can shade them from the switcher. You know, so the whole thing is our ability to control everything, and
you
it just changes everything.
They talk about color timing, and it's called color timing because it was originally how long you left the negatives in the developing bath.
Yep. Yeah.
And so it was literally time, and how it's just it's a fascinating movie. I'll find another pick for the end of the show, but side by side, it's 99 cents right now on Amazon, so it's an inexpensive rental. And
Alex,
you know, Keanu Reeves is the only negative, but he does interview the Wachowskis, which is great because they have a rapport, of course, because they did The Matrix together, and they're fascinating. They're all in on digital. You know, really see this divide. You have Vittorio Sotaro, whatever his name is, the cinematographer, The Godfather, on the one side. And then these new young guys like Fincher and the Wachowskis on the other side, and there's really a gulf. There's a divide.
And Quentin Tarantino, I guess he said he's going to stop making films if he can't have film.
He wants film. But look at Hateful Eight. It's a painting.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know what I did the other day? I got the Blu-ray of Barry Lyndon because I'd read Roger Ebert's pain to it. And he talks about how it was a terrible movie when it came out. I thought it was a horrible movie. It was boring. But I know. I was a complete idiot. But so once I read Ebert's review, I said, "Oh, I have to rethink this movie." And he said, "Every frame is an 18th century painting," and it really is true. It's truly a gorgeous.
It just goes to show there's nothing that's inherently superior about any medium. You just have some filmmakers that their thinking is so locked into 70 millimeter that they can not only can't they think really in terms of doing it in any other way, but they are uniquely well positioned to make the most to make a movie that can't possibly be shot in any other way.
Yeah.
And then you have like the Wachowski sisters that are so digitally minded that they can't you feel as though it would be limiting for them to shoot in anything other than digital or anything that's in any way practical.
That's the word I was looking for. Punter Joe Wachowski in the chat room said, Philistine. Yes, that's what I was. And someday I'll look back at my digs at Keanu Reeves and I'll go, what was I thinking? The greatest actor of our time.
Of our century.
But Barry Lyndon one of the reasons it was bad at the time is because of Ryan O'Neill, who is the most terrific actor. But as Ebert points out, perfect because he's this bland, kind of the banality of evil. He's just this kind of bland creep. So now I appreciate it. And I watched it. But last night I watched Death in Venice, another similar movie from 1971. It's paintings. But when you're, and so I almost realized that when you're a filmmaker and a cinematographer and you're using film, it's almost like what we do as photographers. You're really thinking about
when it's done well.
The film of
and,
it.
And there's a lot of films that you watch that just look like they're assembled. You know, like they said this right story, they had the right close-ups, and then there's ones that are amazingly made, with great editing and, all of those things, that pull it together. One of the great things to do if you, and I will end this week in film in a second, but one of the great things to do is turn off the audio and just watch films because that is the way that you'll see how a film gets. You can't do it if the audio's on because you can't not get caught into it, but take a great film or a film that you like a lot. And I used to do this for every film. I'd watch it once and then I'd watch it again when I, like cutting everything up and trying to observe things, and then I'd watch it silently, and then oftentimes I'd listen to it, and those are kind of the ways I'd feel like through a film that I liked. I didn't do that with every film. I mean, every film that I thought was a good film, because you learn a lot in each one of those things, what the sound design was like or what the framing was like. But
you should really watch Death in Venice. You know, it's funny; it's just very little dialogue,
right?
And so you almost are watching it with the sound off. It's just all natural sound, and it's very slow. And it's a movie you couldn't probably make today,
right?
But Visconti really had that same vision, And of course, it's Venice, so it really is a painting. The whole thing is a painting. All right, we're going to talk. I don't mind talking about this stuff. This is great. This is part of the creative process. And after all, if you're into Macintosh,
it's all done on a Mac.
You're creative. It's all done on a Mac.
There you go. A lot of it's done on a Mac.
Yeah. We'll take a break, come back. We do have some things to say. Renee Ritchie was at the event. Was it this week?
Last Monday.
A week ago?
Yep.
Hard to believe.
So fast.
So we haven't yet, I don't think we got a, I guess, no, we did from Clayton last week. We got kind of a hands-on, but I'd love to hear what your hands-on is. Tomorrow, or day after tomorrow, the new iPads arrive. And it looks like Renee might have a little tiny phone in his hand. Either that or you have massive mitts.
Tiny
He's breaking
tiny...
embargo. He doesn't care anymore.
When did the embargo lift?
Same day. I mean, they didn't have one this time. Yeah, it was nuts. I was so nervous.
Wow. Well, we'll talk about that in just a second. There's a lot to talk about. And, you know, we could talk about movies, too.
Excellent.
Everybody in this room is into movies.
If we haven't lost them by episode 500,
let's shake them off.
We're spending all the goodwill we have left.
We do what it says on the side of the box.
Which is nothing. It's a show about nothing.
We're taking a break. We're breaking from the Mac.
We are going to actually take a little break to talk about the Drobo, which is a very Mac-ish device. I remember when the first Drobos came out, and they were a sponsor of MacBreak when they first came out, I believe.
Yep, absolutely.
And I remember Scott Bourne bought like 800 of them, and there was a little Drobo house.
Yes.
Drobo Fest.
They've come a long way, baby. I love the new Drobos. They're really – this is the Drobo Mini. I really, really like this. This is mine. So don't get any ideas, Lindsay.
I bought one myself.
Yeah, it's a really good idea because it's small, which means it's portable. So if you are recording massive amounts of video from an OZO camera, or you are a videographer, a photographer, and you're traveling, and you want to have redundant backup, this is a great solution. On the back of the Drobo Mini, you'll see it has two Thunderbolt ports, a USB 3 port, and I love the locking connector. I mean, this is the opposite of MagSafe. You can't get it out. If you stumble on this wire,
that's MagSecure.
MagSecure for data.
You don't want it to fall out, right?
Exactly.
As with all Drobos, the magnetic panel has lights that tells you what's going on inside the Drobo, but can also be removed. And the Drobo can be updated while in operation. All of these drives are hot swappable. I'll prove it. I'll pull it out right now. I think it's okay to do that.
No, don't do it.
Not during a write, maybe. But what's nice is what happens if you fill up the capacity of any drive. And the thing that Drobo does, they call it Beyond RAID. Normally, if you have a RAID 5 enclosure, the smallest drive in the enclosure determines the size of all the drives. If you have five or six drives and they're all 5 terabytes, but one's 1 terabyte, they all show up as 1 terabyte drives. Not with a Drobo. It's additive. You can mix and match, which is really great because it means you can take whatever drives you've got and throw them in. When a drive gets full, or the capacity of the Drobo, of course, is the total of all of those minus some percentage for redundancy. But when it starts to fill up any individual drive, a light goes off, and you just pop it out, and you put in a new one. It rebuilds. And you're using it the whole time. You're good to go the whole time. And this one has a really nice feature. I won't pop this out, but I will show you. You can also add, and this is optional. You don't have to add it, but it has a mSATA SSD slot for acceleration. So we've put an SSD in here, and that really speeds up copies of small files, reads of small files. So really useful if you use Lightroom or Apple Photos, and you're transferring a lot of small files around. This is a real speed up. Now, that's the Drobo Mini. This is a direct connect drive, perfect for traveling. But there's also the 5N, which is their network attached storage. You can use that as a media server, a file server, a backup solution. You just plug it into your router.
And I have the 5N at home, and then my travel one is this little one.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people we know are all in on Drobo. The apps let you backup data to two different cloud service providers. So, or you can use BitTorrent Sync or a mix of the above. It also works well with Plex and the new Apple TV. That's the Drobo. And there's the 5D with 5 drives up to 40 terabytes. They just released the B810i. This is an iSCSI SAN. 8 bays. That means up to 64 terabytes. And data-aware tiering offers storage capabilities usually found in much more expensive enterprise solutions. Believe me, I wish they'd had this when we bought our SAN. You can use it for collaboration, testing, development, backup. Smart volumes let you create up to 255 individual drives, each with a maximum capacity of 64 terabytes. So you can do the math. I don't know how that adds up. That's a mess of storage, a passel. And, of course, as with all Drobos, they're reliable. Data received by your Drobo, not yet written to disk, is protected. If there's a sudden power loss, it's got its own battery inside. And, of course, that eUSB device to protect the data if there's power failure. You can add or replace drives easily. You saw I did it. No tools required. Beyond RAID. They're fast. You can get Ethernet, iSCSI, Thunderbolt, USB 3. Visit Drobo.com/twit. You can find out more. Check out their complete line of products and use the code TWIT100 when you buy to save $100. What? $100 off the purchase of a Drobo Mini, a 5D, a 5N, or the new Drobo 810i. Drobo.com/twit, and the offer code is TWIT100. You know what I did with this? I paired this with my Corning optical Thunderbolt cables.
Nice.
I know.
That's fast.
I like our sponsors. And but that way I can put this, you know, at a because I have a pretty silent system.
Put it next door.
I could put it down underneath the desk,
somewhere else,
out of the way. Mm-hmm. And I'm not even aware it's there. It's just magic. It's like it just happens.
The future, Leo.
The future's here. Yeah. We live in the future. So the big story we should probably start with, and I'm really curious what you all think about this. You know, when there's a dearth of information, conspiracy theories pour in to fill the void.
Yeah, exactly.
The DOJ told the court yesterday,
yep.
Never mind. We found a way to unlock the iPhone. Apple doesn't have to do anything, and we are withdrawing our suit to compel Apple to assist in unlocking that 5C used by the San Bernardino shooter. That's it. We're all done. Now, there are a couple of things. First of all, we don't know what the vulnerability is or who offered it. Could it even been Apple? But there is a big question. If there's a vulnerability, will the government tell Apple so they can patch it? And I'm thinking...
I doubt it,
right? Because they want to keep...
It's also unclear if the government actually had it, because I think the recent rumors were that some consulting company offered it to them. So sort of like that hacker group that got hacked previously. There's groups around the world that collect 0 days and other exploits and jailbreak exploits. And if they offered their services to the government, then that, you know, they came in, gave them a phone, they broke it, gave it back to the government.
Well, so I just told you what we know. Now, yes. Everything else we say is filling the void because there's so much we don't know.
Yeah, well, they're not going to show us, but I'd like to see the data if they think that they really got, if they say they really got it off. I'd like to see what that was, because
but they said it in court, so I don't know if they would lie about getting data off.
No, I'm sure they did.
Got something off of it.
I'm sure they did.
Helps remember that they have, because this entire action was based on the All Writs Act. They have to withdraw if they have the ability to do this without Apple's help. So basically, yeah. their entire premise became invalid as soon as they had the ability to do it. And also, there's a lot of interesting language in there. They did say definitely that it was an outside company for anybody inside Apple to even, hey, let's just settle this, let's just fix this. For them to have had any involvement in this after they stuck their neck out that far would be a ridiculous thing to even contemplate. But you realize that an outside company can also mean a government contractor in McLean, Virginia, whose one client is the United States government. So,
but it does, you know, it does kind of underscore what Tim Cook's been saying all along, because now we know there's a vulnerability, and the government has there is a system they go through about whether they notify Apple or about this or not, and they haven't yet said whether they will, and we may never know if they do.
And there's always vulnerabilities.
But they should.
Every version of iOS has, like, that's how they keep getting jailbroken. And I think, you know, there was Pengu that jailbroke iOS 9.1 because of a vulnerability. Then Apple patched it and they looked for another vulnerability. And that's typically how the game works.
But Apple really ought to have a chance to fix that vulnerability, right? And
absolutely.
It's not any outside party's responsibility to tell Apple how they screwed up and tell them how to fix it. It might be an ethical.
What's an ethical one? It might not be an ethical obligation.
Yeah. But then again, someone in law enforcement might say that if we feel as though we can keep people safe by having this door that only we, excuse me, that very few people, including us, have access to, perhaps it's better that we keep this door open. In the past, they have also. There's at least one published instance in which they have reached out to somebody who is going to be presenting a paper hat, a white hat hacker conference, and they approached this person before they all they had was like the preces of the presentation, and they said, "Oh, that's interesting. Why don't you show us how that works?" And then they were so impressed by it that they made that a classified secret and forbade him from actually presenting, because they wanted this trick to be their exclusive property. So a lot of things can happen.
Well, and I think that it's fair game for the FBI to find. I mean, compared to how apoplectic I was about them forcing Apple to do it, it's fair game for them to figure out a way to crack a phone that has a vulnerability. I think this is their job. This is what they should be doing. Mm-hmm. They, you know, for them to figure out how to get into these to get data, I think is fair game. I don't think that they owe Apple anything to figure it out. Apple's going to have to figure it out. I think that the precedent that was so concerning was the idea that they could force Apple to write new code to spy on people.
Yeah.
That's the part that was scary. Not that they're spying on us, and not that they, you know, could hack into it or are going to hack into it. It was that they could force a company to write, you know, novel code that wasn't already there, you know, to open it up, was opening up a Pandora's box that I thought, you know, I think that was, you know, very dangerous. And I do think that there was some pressure put on them to find another way, because I think that they were, if they had lost the case, the precedent would have been set, and, you know, all of these little openings would have been being closed up, which are still being closed up, but it would have been much worse, I think.
Yeah. If I was doing the movie version of this, then it seemed to me, if I was doing a cinematic version of this, that they decided that this would be the perfect case to try to get the All Writs Act codified or precedent set that would allow them to be able to force and compel companies to write that kind of code. But then over the progressive weeks when Apple fought back, and maybe they weren't expecting that level of pushback, sentiment wasn't as completely on their side as they thought it was. And legal interpretation, including the New York City case, wasn't as on their side as maybe they hoped it would be. And it just became clear that this was a game of chicken that they may not win. And the only thing worse than getting a precedent that would let them overreach to this degree would get a precedent that shut them out of this. So rather than risk that sort of a thing, it felt like they said, okay, we know we're going to take this away. The scary part to me is that this didn't get solved. It's not like a court ruled and said, you can't do this. They took their ball and went home. So this is still hanging over us like a sort of hacking Damocles, where if there's another case like this, they might try again, or they might think there's a better opportunity or a better judge to try it with. So I think that, you know, it's sort of great that this happened, but we have to be very vigilant about how this surfaces next.
Well, and I do feel like that there's, I do feel as though there's more mundane explanations here. And again, we're, as Leo so very wisely covered all of our butts, we're basically, you say the three sentences that are the actual facts of the case that we've revealed, that had been revealed for the past week. And the rest is speculation and opinion, and hopefully informed opinion. But again, the government's hands were tied the moment that they cannot apply this court action the way that they've applied it, so long as they feel as though they have the ability to do this without Apple's help. So I feel as though the reason why they withdrew was because at some point they had information that they didn't have when they first filed this action. And there's also, there is no one entity called the government. There is all kinds of different departments, and a lot of them, if they don't actively hate each other, they're not going to do anything to help each other. My opinion, if I were in Vegas and I had to lay a bet and I wanted to make my money back, I would be saying that there was always another contractor that works with the government that had a way to get through this, but they've had no impulse whatsoever to volunteer their services or this information to the FBI, and that at some point somebody had lunch with the right person.
His name rhyme with Ron McAfee?
Probably not.
Okay.
I'm guessing
I'm
no.
I'm thinking not.
I guess the most impressive thing that he did in that entire exchange was realize that, okay, this is the part in my life where I either go all in and risk and risk being a fool for life, or admit that I said things I should not have said and I'm embarrassed for a couple of weeks. But yeah, I'm certain that at a certain political level they would like this thing settled. I think citizens and corporations would like this topic settled. I don't feel, from what I've been seeing and hearing about this case, I don't feel as though there was any motivation. I believe that the immediate motivation was to get the data on this phone. I also think that they had to have known that by trying to compel Apple to do this, whether the only two possible solutions would be Apple decides that this is not a fight that they want to fight and they comply, or they fight, in which case this gets, even if the FBI wins, it gets drawn out so long that any information on that phone would be of no value. So I feel as though their gambit was, let's at least try to get let's try to compel Apple, and we don't know if we're going to be able to fight them in court over this. But if we can sort of twist their arm and get them with the help of our political wings and for help of public opinion, get them to find a way that they can say that they were only helping out law enforcement without turning their back on their stated position about the defense of private security, I think that that's what they were trying to get at.
Well, I think that the bigger fight is going to probably be in Europe, specifically because Europe has more to more risk. I mean, they have more going on that they need to have that data.
Yeah.
But I think that the fight there is going to be, because the problem is if once one country does it, it just becomes this thing. And so you have all these countries that are looking at trying to legislate that. And Europe, I think, is pulled between two things where they're very privacy driven as well as very security driven. And I don't know if they really have a solution for that yet. I don't think it's going to happen in our Congress anytime soon. I don't think there's an appetite for going down that path.
The EFF says FBI breaks into iPhone. We have some questions. I do feel like this is just kicking the can down the road a little bit.
And yeah,
if you're going to indulge in conspiracy theories, you might say the FBI realized that this wasn't the best case after all to pursue.
The hard thing is the panic effect. Like a lot of people immediately when this happened, there was a lot of headlines saying, can they break into your phone? Which is kind of fear-mongering. I mean, Geohot broke into the original iPhone in his garage with a soldering iron. And we've had jailbreaks for almost every version of the iPhone since. So this is nothing that people have to immediately panic about either. This is, you know, an exploit that was used or whatever. Somehow this iPhone got access to, just like iOS 9.1 was jailbroken a year ago. So it's something that happens and something that hopefully gets patched, but it's nothing that anyone has to panic about.
As the EFF points out, by the way, Renee did not just mispronounce soldering. He's from Canada. It's not his fault.
Soldering. Is it a soldering iron? Okay, I'm sorry.
Teasing you. According to the EFF, there's something called the Vulnerabilities Equities Process the government uses for determining when to disclose. Of course, they had an acronym, VEP, when to disclose security vulnerabilities. If the FBI used a vulnerability to get into the iPhone, the VEP must apply, meaning there should be a very strong bias in favor of informing Apple of the vulnerability, which would allow Apple to fix it.
That's why the language was probably stating that, to try to make it clear that it wasn't they themselves who did it.
Yeah, we don't know. It just magically unlocked.
Also, it's a little bit like a FOIA request where, yes, they can be compelled to give up information, but they can do that in such a way that the information is useless. So they can say they've complied with this law without actually doing anything that they felt really strongly they shouldn't be doing.
President Obama recommended that the policy favor disclosure, quote, in almost all instances for widely used code, unquote. But, there's a lot redacted. Speaking of FOIA, I think that's how the EFF got this.
I think the real policy. Mistake here for the government is that probably as much so as all the Snowden leaks, is what they've done is they flipped everybody to being worried about the government getting into it. So now there's all these tutorials for every person on how to do strong passwords, how to encrypt everything. So there's all these articles that show average people and. Now, anybody who Googles can easily see how they're going to do this that weren't thinking about it before. And now they're going to tighten that all up because, you know, and I just think that they got a lot of press and it was just a huge boondoggle.
Surprise.
And also it's going to double. Apple can now really double down on their promotion of security features. They can make the point, and they have, that the 5C was a couple of generations behind in terms of the hardware security that makes Apple products the hardest things to get into. It's not just something that they can simply apply a system update. It really is, you have to trick hardware, which means that you need to have a scanning electron microscope to watch electrons going by and count them correctly, practically, in order to get data that someone does not want you to get. So this is almost like World War I that ends, but nothing's resolved. And then there's going to be something even worse coming.
Well, and I think the hard part is that now there's a race on for a lot of these governments, because now there's a lot of money being spent on all fronts to get to a point where you can ship 75 or 100 million phones that there just is almost no way to get into, you know, and get them out the door, you know, with all this encryption. There's always going to be some back door, but it can get very hard if these companies really get focused on it at a level that they haven't been before, because now they want to get it out before, and to say that basically we can't get into it, and doesn't matter whether you legislate it or not, it is almost impossible to get in.
A little crypto break.
Apple has a pretty strong arm here in that they are one of the world's premier luxury brands. Right. And that if your government says that, I'm sorry, we're going to make the iPhone 7 illegal to import into this country, you're gonna have to make your case so carefully about why you're making that happen, given that the number of people, millions of people, that were expecting to have a brand new shiny iPhone 7, they want this thing. I often have to think about how the week before 9/11, remember one of the killers went through Logan Airport. I remember just a couple of weeks before that, on the local news, there was a long report about how there's a lot of pushback against security at Logan, and they're thinking about loosening security requirements because people are really annoyed at how much time it's taking for them to get through screenings. And oftentimes, so long as I don't want to be callous here, but as soon as the names of the victims have been forgotten by all but the friends and families, that's when people start thinking of, oh, do I really have to take off my shoes? Oh, God, do I really have to put my laptop in a separate thing? And when you get to a point where you're telling people you're going to have to get a Samsung Galaxy phone instead of an iPhone because we're not going to allow this to be imported in, that's when, unfortunately, people start to ask more serious and harder questions.
Do you think that, one of the things the New York Times raised, we talked a little bit, Katie Benner was on Twit from the Times on Sunday. Do you think Apple makes itself more vulnerable by not offering bug bounties as Google and Facebook do for vulnerabilities? They say, we don't want to get in that ever-escalating game.
More vulnerable or less informed?
Yeah, I think that they should do it. I think they should.
Google actually made that as part of their I think for the last analyst call, or rather the last time when it came time to hand out the latest round, they were actually making, just like Apple makes a big deal of, here's how many billions of dollars we've handed out to developers on the App Store. They made a big point in part of that call of, here's how much money we have handed out to people who have found vulnerabilities in our hardware. And rather than pointing it at, well, really, that's how many vulnerabilities they found, they've made the more cogent argument that, look, there are going to be vulnerabilities that we are not going to be able to spot on our own. And here's how we're putting our money where our mouth is. And here's how much eager we are to make the most secure handsets and software that we possibly can. So, yeah, I think they should do that.
Yeah.
What would it cost them?
Could cost them a lot. The government has offered $1 million bounty for 0-day flaws.
People are going to shop around.
That's what I think, that's what Apple's worried about. Google offers as much as $100,000 for flaws in Android.
And there are security companies that want them too, because then they offer those services to governments.
Right. So it's a very, could
big
be
business.
Expensive. Not that Apple doesn't have the money, but happy birthday, OS 10. That's what the cake's really for. 15 years we've been using OS 10. And Apple's been updating it yearly for how long? Almost like eight of those? Half of that time, at least.
From Kodiak to El Capitan.
Yeah. April 25th, there will be a live stream of Apple's 2016 Q2 earnings call. Is that unusual?
It's becoming more and more usual. We actually do a couple of them. not Apple's, but we
you
do.
Broadcast them.
We broadcast for other corporations.
I remember watching video of Marissa Meyer last year.
Did they say video, Leo? Because they always do the audio call. The audio call has been happening for years.
Can anybody call into that, or do you have to be a journalist?
There's a little player on the apple.com/investor. Oh, okay. There's a little audio player. You press it, and it just plays the audio.
Okay.
He goes, this is Tim.
No, it's a conference call again, it looks like, yeah.
Every time. So, this is the only one with that accent, but every time he tells you, it's Tim.
Yeah. Well, April 25th. I don't know why we're talking about this now. April seems so far away, and yet...
It's only a few days.
It's just a couple of days.
I know. So fast.
Spring is coming. All right, let's talk about the iPhone SE. It's not a 5. It's not a 6. No. It's just an SE. You got it right there.
Yeah, rose gold, Leo.
The heart of a 6S and the exact same body of a 5S.
So, right? Yeah, so it's a 5S. Right. The camera and the processor are the same as a 6S, and the Wi-Fi and the Stellar are the same as a 6. The FaceTime camera is the same as a 5S, so it's really
very
a hybrid.
Complicated.
All the different
But they
phones.
Didn't have to. I feel like Johnny Ive this semester just took a little sabbatical.
He's been working on the new campus, Leo. He's putting all that curved glass in.
Because they didn't. There's no. This is not a new external design in any way. This is, in fact, the cases for the 5S work.
Yeah, so I mean, the point that they tried to make, and you know, whether you believe them or not, is something else, is that people loved this phone, that there are people hanging on to 5 and 5S for a long time, and they thought the design was iconic, and they didn't like the new curvier design. They liked sort of the brawn and lake sort of look of the four and the 5 series, and this gives them basically the device that they want, but with all the specs that they were lusting after.
All my 5S cases, not so long.
Well, I'm so excited. I have this underwater case. I have this underwater case that I couldn't use anymore because it was a 5S case. And I'm very excited.
I still have my what are those lenses? I do have my lenses in the
right.
So yeah. Yeah.
The auto clip. Yeah. And so again, though, this is like, if you had a 5 or a 5S, this is the exact same phone, but you get all the goodies and Apple Pay and Touch ID and everything that you might not have had otherwise.
It's not slower Touch ID, right?
Touch ID first generation. Yeah.
First gen. Why? That seems odd.
So, I mean, there's a couple things there. One, like, there's always the chance that they just wanted to make a certain bill of goods, and there were certain things they were willing to sacrifice. Right. Yeah. The other thing is that, especially early on, some of the new chips are really hard to make, which is why we only saw Touch ID on the iPhone at first, and it took a while to go to iPad. And if Touch ID 2 is similar, then the yield rates aren't really enough for them to roll it out beyond one product, especially when that product line is the iPhone, and they're making 100 million of them.
And
it's
yet,
hard to get those other devices.
2 gigs of RAM.
Yeah, because it's the exact same. On the iPhone, the chip is all built together. The RAM, it's not like the X, so the RAM is inside.
Got it.
So it's the exact same A9 chip that's in. So to me, it's like the Ducati Superleggera or like a Porsche 911R, where it's all the engine, but they took everything out of the body they possibly could. And there's very few pixels, so it really flies.
Yeah, and how's battery life? I think it must be spectacular, right?
Really good, because it's not as long. And battery, one of the reasons why the iPhone Plus, the 6 Plus is so good, is because it lets them spread that battery over a large volume. Making a battery thick is not great for a lot of reasons, but making it big by volume, by surface area, is really good. This one is smaller, but because of the relative size of it, and it's the more efficient, Apple A9 chip, it's hours longer than the 5S was. I've only had it for a few days, and so it's hard to test, because when you set up a phone as new, it also downloads, and then it re-indexes everything, which uses the processor a lot, so it's hard to tell, but it's been lasting me easily through a day.
Nice. Is there a market for a 4-inch iPhone? I guess there is. They said 30 million were sold last
year. Yeah, 10 to 20% have been waiting apparently to upgrade. And they also think they'll get some people who are just, because it's hard to find small flagship phones. But if you have small pockets, if you have small purses, like a Christina Warren clutch sort of a thing, you want the smaller phone because it's easy to carry and people have been waiting for it. So anyone who just doesn't want a big phone, no matter who the manufacturer is, anybody who might have a regular phone and they're looking to get into a smartphone and they like that little candy bar form factor, they're used to their Nokias and their Samsung candy bars, and want a smartphone that size, they think they have a good opportunity with all those.
Looks like I picked a pretty bad week to give up my lady clutch.
You can borrow
It's not just that. This touches so many hot spots here. It's not, because not only all the stuff that Renee was talking about, but also Apple now has a really awesome $399 phone in a world in which you can get awesome $300 Android phones. I love it when the minimum buy-in for an Apple product gets lower.
Yeah.
I think the same thing they did kind of that Google did with the Nexus 6P and the Nexus 5X. They didn't decide to make a cut rate version, a lower citizen standard of iPhone. They basically made anything that the 6P can do, pretty much this can also do. You don't have to say, well, I can't do Apple Pay. I can't do the good photography I can do with the 6P. It really is a choice.
So nice.
Exactly. I'm amazed by it. I'm so pleased that they put pretty much the same camera. I don't have hardware, but I've been talking to my people at Apple, and they said that, no, you can't expect that the same pictures that you could take with the iPhone 6P, you'll be able to take they need to have a standardized on what
yes.
letters they're going to put after thing. I will always screw that up. But anyway, that the same pictures you can take on the iPhone 6, you can also take on the iPhone SE. That's so such a pleasure.
Now, on the iPad, the 9.7-inch iPad
Pro.
It's kind of a weird mix of new and old. Have you confirmed that it's 2 gigs of RAM in there?
Yes.
That's very disappointing.
So, I mean, there's a couple of things. So, in some ways, it's way better. In other ways, like you said, there's 2 gigs of RAM. So, it's smaller. RAM does use a little bit of power, but you know, it's not really significant. It has far fewer pixels to push around. So, it doesn't need as big a buffer for that kind of thing. But
that's a good point. So, it uses RAM as a frame buffer for the screen.
Yeah, so like you would like the original iPhone 6 Plus, you could tell that sometimes it was having a hard time moving all those pixels around. But then they went to 2 gigs with that, and they've gone to 4 gigs for the big one. But the big one has a much bigger screen resolution than this one does. And I'll turn it on. But in some ways, it's way better. Like, so for example, the camera is the same camera as the iPhone SE and the iPhone 6 Plus. So the camera is way better. The screen is way better because it has that 25% brighter and 40% less reflective. And it has DCI-P3 color space. So it's got the wide gamut color screen, like the 5K Mac. So it's in some ways, it's startlingly advanced. And in other ways, it's like, the RAM.
I'm so excited about when we were looking at it, when the Ethernet, we finally tested the Ethernet.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
So we did it took me a little while to get all the little bits and pieces I've been traveling and between Monday and here and I finally got all the bits and pieces, and you know, it's been around. I mean, it works on your phone, it works on the iPad Pro, it works. It's just that they happened to mention it. There you go. That's what I'm talking about.
And I've had this in my bag for an entire week, and like, yay!
Oh my gosh, you know, I was like,
where do you guys find Ethernet?
Oh,
well, you just use
it on Amazon.
It turns out it comes out of the wall.
Some of the strangest places, I guess, right?
I think hotels. I don't know if they still do, but
yeah,
the
hotel I was just in had it.
Yeah.
I actually get my hotels based on whether they have Ethernet in the room. Okay. So
charging over USB-C, Leo, so fast. It's even on the big iPad.
Yeah, that I believe.
Yeah. You have to do that. So that's exclusive to the big iPad, isn't it? Also USB 3 data transfer, isn't it?
USB 3 data transfer is exclusive to the big one. I've been charging this on the USB-C cable. I don't know if I should have been or not, but it's been fine.
Sure, why wouldn't you? I mean, it wouldn't take, it wouldn't hurt.
Oh, no, it'll charge. I don't know what, I need to check my notes, because right now
it's USB 2. Yeah.
Okay. No, so it's a slow bandwidth, but it's got the USB-C charging capability.
Yeah, so iPad,
go ahead. I was just going to ask if it has a fast USB-C charging or slow charging.
I didn't try, but I'll test that tonight.
And okay. And so the data transfer rate isn't there, but you can use Ethernet.
Yes.
And that all that means you could use, in theory, you could have done that before. They just didn't have a driver. So all it means is that the operating system has a driver built in.
Yeah, I don't know whether that is that a 9.3 thing that you can suddenly use Ethernet, or was that something we could always use and we just didn't know? Because it was
we tried before and it didn't work.
Yeah, exactly. I've been trying with previous connectors. I don't. That's another set of questions I don't have answers to yet. But I've got questions on whether there is hardware, whether there's a combination of drivers and circuitry that's inside this adapter, or whether there has been some secret sauce that it needed for hardware to make that happen. I don't know. But it is a big deal. Just to quickly answer what you're asking earlier, Leo. The problem is that when you don't have Wi-Fi, you will start looking for Ethernet when you don't have Wi-Fi. And the number of times where I've been like at a conference, and the fact that I always travel with like a Hutu like a $15 mini Wi-Fi base station, and had to loan it to another conference speaker because there's Wi-Fi throughout the hotel, but in some rooms it really stinks. And that was their ability to on their little MacBooks to finally be able to connect to the internet. You really do need, and especially with the iPad, where if you don't have being able to travel with it as an alternative to your MacBook or your Windows notebook, really is required that you have an access to the internet. That's why I took both the iPad Pro and my MacBook with me to Yosemite a couple weeks ago, because I knew that the internet would be terrible and things would be really, really horrible for me if I didn't have access to that. So if you're already going to be spending $30 for this thing that will give you all the crunchy goodness that a USB port gives you, why not also have the ability to plug in an Ethernet adapter? It really does.
Renee, have you tried Ethernet with the SE as well?
I have not. Okay. I can give that a go. But the thing, like at Tandy's point too, sometimes Wi-Fi just gets saturated when there's a lot of people around. Yeah. And one of the things, like at Moscone, you always want to go try to find an Ethernet plug.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I understand. Look, believe me, we're the ones who tell everybody you can't be on the show unless you have Ethernet.
Well, and that's the whole thing is now absolutely. We could theoretically use our iPad, you know, for a show like this.
For Skyping.
You know, for Skyping. Yeah. And for us, you know, we use it for comms and controls for our switchers and the number one reason we didn't use it to control our ATEM, our Blackmagic switchers or our mixers. We can control, you know, our Yamaha and Behringer mixers with the iPad, but we won't do it on a show because we need to have a wired connection to make sure nothing goes down. And having this is the you know, the process. And I think that one of the things we want to test is now, you know, they have all, a lot of people have been playing around with using your iPads and your iPhones as cameras to do multi-camera shoots and everything else. And I've always been like, well, I'm not going to do that over Wi-Fi. But now the idea that I could hub all of these pieces into it, you know, is it's exciting. So it's,
and
it's,
you have the powered cool connection too. So like Jason and I and Snell and I were both clapping when they said podcasts.
Yay. All right, we're going to take a break. I have many more questions. I want to know about the keyboard as well. Did you get the keyboard case?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep,
right, don't hold on. We're going to get to it in a minute.
No spoilers.
No spoilers. Rene Ritchie is here, iMore.com. He's got the new iPhone and the new iPad. We get our iPad mini pros tomorrow, whatever. Baby pro.
Baby
little,
pro.
Little pro. We get the semi pro.
Semi pro.
Semi pro is good.
Yeah.
Because in a way it is. I want to talk about the screen thing too. Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
True tone.
But we, yeah, not tomorrow, Thursday, the 31st they come out. But first, Rene Ritchie's here, Andy Anacco from the Chicago Sun-Times, Alex Lindsay. Are you? Did you order some mini baby pros?
Couple?
Like 153?
No,
okay. I'm building something that I needed.
Some.
A few.
Alex has a unique relationship to numbers. Yeah. One too many.
there's that.
And then there's the unit of, you know,
free,
costs.
Cheap, irrelevant.
Yeah.
You just have to, it doesn't matter how much it costs. It just matters how fast you can amortize it.
Exactly. How much it will make you.
So you just have to move. You just have to make sure that you know where the other end of that stick is. So
our show today brought to you by Atlassian. If you've ever worked on a team, you probably have heard of Atlassian, and I hope you've used Atlassian. We have. Oh, we love Atlassian. We used it with the design of the website. That's where I first encountered it, because they used Jira. Our web design team, Four Kitchens down in Austin, used Jira. And so we did the whole Agile thing. It doesn't have to be Agile, but it is a really great way to manage a big project. We have many programmers, many clients, and you all kind of have input. And it worked so beautifully. And, of course, because we were using Atlassian Jira, they used HipChat as our kind of chat client. And now as we design the new studio, we just opened the new room in HipChat. We used to have many HipChat channels for engineering, for the website, for ops, and our new studio design. And we're using it as an idea book for the design. So we're putting pictures in there and ideas. And we've gotten to the point now where we're telling all of our team members who are working on this new studio, don't email me, put it in HipChat, please. It's really great. And you can do video chatting, and you tie it in. We tie it in with a lot of our services, like Redis. And we use a new service I love called Panopta that lets us know when servers are down or funky. And it comes across as a message, and I get a notification on my phone. I just love HipChat. Then Russell uses Confluence for trouble tickets, to keep an eye on what's going on, bring team members up to speed, share content, organize results. The only thing I don't know if we use, and I should ask Patrick, our programmer, is a Bitbucket, which is for testing, reviewing, and managing code in real time. Basically, I think you're getting the idea. Atlassian has the tools you need to make your life easier. I was just reading a post from Joel Spolsky from like 100 years ago, from like 2000, in which he says, never take a job unless they're using the best tools. You just don't want to work somewhere if they're not using the best tools. We use the best tools. You should use the best tools. Atlassian.com, Atlassian, to learn more about Jira, Confluence, HipChat, Bitbucket. Atlassian.com. Unleash the potential in your team and build what's next. And thank you, Atlassian, for making great tools for us to use. All right, let's continue on. So, keyboard, let's see it. It's smaller because it has to.
It is.
It's got to be the size of a.
It's smaller on the outside.
Yeah. How did they? So did they move keys closer together or shrink the keycap size?
Both. So okay. They basically, there's no bezel on the side anymore. It goes completely edge to edge, almost like the MacBook. The keys are smaller. It took me about 5 minutes to get used to it. I don't type as well on it as I do the full size one, but autocorrect really kicks in. So as long as you trust it and you just keep typing, it does really, really good job. I used it the entire plane ride back. Then I used it the plane ride out here, and I've been using it in the hotel here because the footprint is so small. It takes up very little space on the table, so it's super convenient to carry and use with you, and I've been having no problem at all with it.
Yeah, now, that's why I bought it, because I actually came to love the original Pro and its keyboard. Yeah, it was really useful, not for writing long screeds, but just having a keyboard really means I can keep the screen free of that pop-up keyboard.
And 9.3 supports the keyboard way better.
Yeah.
So I was going to say,
one of the things that was my frustration with the Pro until recently is that it was a little funky. You know,
arrow,
like, you'd be typing.
Didn't work.
Well, and you'd be typing, and it would suddenly, like, lose stuff and everything else.
I hated that.
And
I thought that was the docking port.
I'm talking about silly things like using Spotlight the same way that I use it on the desktop, which is command space to bring up a search box, launch Skype or something like that. On the Pro, it would highlight it for you, but then you had to reach up and tap it because you couldn't select it with an arrow key and then launch with. And just that simple addition, that in and of itself, I don't care if it does brick my iPad. That makes 9.3 a good upgrade for me.
It's so fast now. I use it like I use a Mac. I don't even think about it. And the nice thing is, because all those things work the same, I don't have to think. I don't have to remember that I'm on a Mac or an iOS device.
Yeah.
I just type, and it almost always does what I expect it to do.
Well, and I've been I've had a couple times now. The last couple of weeks, I keep on losing my power supply for my computer, and I end up just having to be on a flight. Or I was in my hotel room over the weekend in Vancouver without a power supply, and just using my iPad Pro, and I had to do spreadsheets, and I had to do presentation stuff, and I had to do, and I'm just sitting there just like working away. And actually, the split screen when you're working on something like that is just pretty awesome.
It's amazing.
How is the split screen on the smaller 9.7 inch? Does it still?
So I'm going to give you two answers, Leo. Like, I really, really like it. And not everything supports it yet. Google Docs, famously, they still use UI WebView, the original web component, because they want to manage their own cookies. So that doesn't play nice with a lot of modern stuff. So if you're using that, you might have trouble. But if you're using Microsoft or anything else, it works really, really well. The only thing is, I'm getting to the age where my eyes aren't as good as they used to be. So that I got used to that big screen, because then split apps were basically the size of iPad Air apps. And on the iPad, the 9.7 inch iPad Pro, they're basically the size of iPad mini apps. So you have two iPad mini apps side by side. So I'm putting it a little bit closer than I used to, and then it's fine.
And I find the behavior on some of the split apps are a little funky, even with Apple's apps. You know, the numbers is a little like there's a whole bunch of stuff that it doesn't want to, you know, doesn't want to do when it's the split app. But I find that the Google Docs works just as badly on the iPad as it does on the. we use Google Docs, so I run my whole company on Google Docs.
Us too.
So there's a love hate relationship there. Is that you can't do any, you can't, you know, you have to use it because it's the only thing that does what it does well. But there's lots of weird little editing tools when you're trying to, you know, have lists and things that it wants to do something that I don't want it to do, and trying to persuade it not to is just as hard on the iPad as it is on the.
Yeah. Now, the camera in there is the first time they've ever put a decent camera in an iPad, which is truly awesome. I was with a bump. They even have a bump. I was like many skeptical about iPadography for a long time, but I've come around, and I'm kind of excited about that. It also has a flash, right?
Yeah, it's got the same True Tone flash as the other one. And it's a huge, beautiful viewfinder. I was using both the iPad Pro and this one. We use this as CES to do a lot of close-up shots. And I was using macros. I was doing a lot of macro photography over the weekend. And just a viewfinder this size makes it so easy to be tack sharp on anything you want to be.
Yeah.
It's really amazing, especially for shooting 4K.
It also has, and you've finally gotten a chance to play with, we were talking about during the launch, this new thing where it adjusts to the lighting of the room, and it has four ambient lighting sensors.
Do you like
two four-channel sensors?
Two four-channel sensors. What do you think?
So we took it to the XYZ bar at the Aloft Hotel, because that's almost like a disco, and we wanted to try it out.
Wow.
And it's really crazy, because we've all seen photographs of an iPhone where the iPhone looks white and the screen looks yellow or blue, and you put this on, and they did this in the demo room for us too, and the screen just goes normal color, and it's like you're looking at a piece of paper. And I hadn't realized how yellow or blue the screens were, and then I picked up my iPhone, and I'm like, wow, this screen is blue, because I was looking at the iPad next to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's just one little switch, but it's to the point now where I wish my other Apple devices would detect the settings on this and then automatically replicate it. Because it's hard to demo.
Because I was afraid it would be distracting.
The night shift can be distracting.
I'm not crazy about night shift, and I'm also really skeptical yellow about that blue being a problem.
But. Mm-hmm.
And then you just flip the switch, and it immediately sort of makes it white. And it's hard to see, but in a room, when you're actually looking at it in front of you, it does switch from looking like a yellow-blue screen to looking like a white piece of paper.
And we talked about this, Alex, but just let's refresh my memory. Is this something that would be good for photo editing or bad for photo editing?
I would be tempted to say bad.
Well, you don't want the colors to shift.
Here's the issue is that when you color, the truth is that when you color correct a monitor for color correction, you are taking into account the ambient light. So scientifically, it should be the right thing to do because you never want to color correct a monitor somewhere else and bring it to where you're at because it will
need to be redone.
Be different for your eyes. But that said, having the computer do that for me makes me very cautious, concerned.
Well, also,
upset.
Your eyes adjust to ambient light.
It does, but the idea is that you want your eyes and the screen to be in sync so that you're seeing true color. Right. I'm a little, but it still concerns me to have it doing that. I mean, I just have to play with it some more to see. But
now, the best way I can describe it is that in before this technology, the white of the bezel, if you had a white iPad, the white of the bezel would look different than the white of the screen because the screen would be bluish or yellowish compared to it. And when you turn this on, the whites actually look similar again, which is kind of neat. So it looks like there's only kind of one white for you to look at.
Yeah. So somebody has put a link to a Scientific American article. It's got the word science in it, so that's a good thing. Why blue light
is bad.
As long
as you're blinded by
your sleep. I'm still skeptical.
Georgia did a really good article for us on this, too. And she's like, it doesn't really help because most people, when they have their device on, are playing Candy Crush or using Facebook.
The light is the problem, not the color of the light. You're shining light into your eyes. Your eyes are always... I think this whole thing about blue and yellow and all that... Human eyes don't see it. You don't suddenly go outside and say, wow, it's blue out here, because our eyes adjust.
Well, Jordan,
what we know now all of a sudden, because of cameras which don't adjust, we know, fluorescents are green and the daylight is blue and the incandescent light's yellow. But eyes never knew that until cameras
explained it. Well, until they were trained. I mean, the thing is that when you do a lot of this, when you can walk into a room, and I couldn't do it when we started doing a lot of interviews and stuff like that. But now you walk into the room and you look around and you go, oh, that's 56 or 42 or 32. And you're not right on, but you can very quickly, the big thing is that as soon as you start measuring it, as soon as you're out there, like looking at what is that, and your eye starts to calibrate, to outside, inside, so on and so forth, you can start to see it pretty quickly, about what kind of temperature you're in.
The way that I understand it is that your body builds up melatonin during the day, and that's what helps you fall asleep and stay asleep. And the short wavelengths of light, the blue wavelengths, actually suppress melatonin and build up histamine, which causes an opposite. It's a keep awake sort of a chemical reaction. And by shifting down the blue light, now it's arguable whether Apple's doing it enough to make any real difference. But if you do shift to warmer wavelengths of light, then you're no longer suppressing the melatonin and no longer building up the histamine. Whether that makes a difference to you depends on your overall sleep hygiene. And again, playing video games or using social networks can be a much more energizing thing than
just
light.
Shining light into your eyes in the middle of the night is probably the biggest signal to your body. What color the light is probably secondary.
But I think there's a scientific...
TV, there's adrenaline. You mean there's all sorts of things.
But there's a scientific equilibrium that can be adjusted. You can use the light or you can just use more whiskey.
Right. Or take some melatonin.
There you go.
Actually, more whiskey solves everything.
Or more whiskey.
If I want to sleep well, I take Steve Gibson's patented supplement formula that literally just knocks me out. It just knocks me out. You got to take
next
a look.
Time you have
I find 15-year-old Macallan.
It's about 80 pills worth.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But
are they little black pills?
I think you should put them in your Macallan because they're all, you can twist them off. Just
are they like little black pills?
No, they're white.
Stuff them in your ears so that's quieter. I'm really interested in this topic because in the past couple of months, I've really been trying to address my sleep hygiene, my sleep habits, because it's one of those things where you realize that what I could get away with at age 22 is not what I can get away with at age 2 times 22. And so I've had to really start having the rule where look at midnight, 1 p.m., doesn't matter what's going on. You have to stop what you're doing and go to bed. And you have to turn off all the lights. No sound, no screens of any kind. You can't fall asleep watching a movie. You have to do this. And I think that a lot of people are they'll be writing and talking about this this new feature of iOS without deciding that, 6 hours minimum, 8 hours optimal every night without using like a sleep tracker app to actually look at the numbers. Because it's worth experimenting with because you have no idea how much of your day you're losing by getting only 5 hours of sleep the night before or just being keyed up until the moment that you drop off to sleep.
And for me, I have to admit that I won't generally when I get home. And now I have to admit, I get home from work about 8. I don't open my laptop or my iPad almost ever after I get home. I'll still respond to stuff on my phone, but it really limits how much I can think. And so I do find it important. I find it more important than light is to stop interacting with mm-hmm. things that I have to make decisions. I think that's, for me, the big thing.
So Apple's putting a hold on the update to iOS 9.3. What's going on, Renee?
So I believe that ended early last night, but they originally, iOS 9.3, there was some problems with activating. Some people said older devices, some people had the problem on newer devices too, but basically the activation system, which is what says this is an authorized device and you can open it up and start using it again, wasn't working. So people weren't able, either they were asked for a password they didn't have, or they put in their password and it didn't work, and it left the device unactivated after the update. So they pushed out a couple server-side fixes. Apple can do hot fixes is on the servers because it's the server team that actually pushes the update. So they tried a few things very early on, and then those didn't work. So they put out an actual new build number. I think they've done two new build numbers now, one last Wednesday or Thursday, and one, I think, again last night. And as far as I know, that's rectified the problem for almost everybody now.
Did we know what the problem, I mean, why it was happening? It was crashing when you tapped a link.
That was a separate issue. So that I don't believe is fixed yet. So the original problem was that it could not activate the device. Whatever process it was using to ping Apple's activation servers, it wasn't responding in a correct way. And that I believe now is fixed. The link issue, people were trying to troubleshoot it. So basically you tap a link and nothing would happen. And you try to hold down the link and the app would freeze. And some people traced it down to an app called bookings.com. And if you installed that app, that's when the problem would start. A few people said there might be other apps like it. It sounds like that app was not managing the amount of data it was putting into it and just basically overflowing the process. But there's apparently a new version of iOS 9.3 is going to come out to address that as well.
Okay.
So sort of like a rogue app situation.
Yeah, because I haven't had that problem. I haven't had it, yeah.
No, if you didn't have one of those apps installed, it's the URL scheme got overloaded. If you didn't have those apps installed, then you were fine.
Of course, it's that URL scheme.
It's a scheme for a reason, Leo.
That again. That was the one that they were suing Samsung over, right? And then they lost.
Well, it's also the one that people, I mean, it was a way to do inter-app communication before there was proper inter-app communication.
Funky.
So you leave yourself open to a lot of things.
Right. Not worth any energy, but what do you think of the rumor that not this year, but next year, there's going to be a curved glass iPhone 8 with a 5.8-inch AMOLED display?
I say, sure.
Yeah, whatever. Ming-Chi Kuo, baby. It's Ming-Chi Kuo.
If you look at like Intel is like making the future is hard, and Intel had to shift to a tick-tock cycle this time just to get down to 10 nanometers. So they're actually doing Broadwell, Skylake, Kaby Lake, and Apple usually does a tick-tock system. And if this is true, it means that the tock is not going to be ready.
Tick-tock-tock.
So they'll do tick-tock-tock as well, where they get as far as they can this year and then push it a step further next year. It is the same way it's a miracle that Windows boots up on a million different computers a million different SKUs every day. It's a miracle that Apple gets every single piece of technology ready for a new iPhone launch every year. So I have no problem. Like, I don't have any specific information on this, but I have no problem believing that all the time they make more conservative prototypes and more ambitious prototypes.
Right.
And if the ambition one doesn't work out because the components aren't quite ready or they can't produce them at scale, then you get the more conservative one, and the year after they try again.
When you're, like 20 months out, you may see prototypes of all kinds. The fact that they exist is in no way indicative of what will be released in the fall of 2017.
Yeah, and what works in a prototype does not mean it works when you make 100 million of them. That's
and particularly the AMOLED displays, which Apple has. AMOLED display. I am of the opinion AMOLED displays are far superior to the IPS LCD displays Apple uses. But they're made by Samsung.
The bigger problem is that Apple has 3D Touch is bound to the LED backlight. It measures the deformity. So if you get rid of the LED backlight, they're going to have to figure out a new way to do 3D Touch with AMOLED. The other potential solution, though, is Quantum Dot, which some people think is as good as, if not better than, AMOLED.
Yeah, we're seeing those on TVs now. Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But they don't have some of the age out issues that AMOLED displays do. But are they ready in time, and are they ready at iPhone scale in time? So again, it's really hard to juggle all these things, like you said, 20 months out.
I am such a fan of the AMOLED screen on the Galaxy S7. It's just gorgeous, and I would love to see something like that on
that new LG television set.
Oh yeah, the new OLED television, but that's OLED, right? The LG television set. Yeah.
I have to admit, I've only seen it in the inside the VR. The Gear VR. We have them, but we only got them.
Oh, that's right.
You put
them in the Gear VR.
So we see these phones as just like Gear VR screens.
Yeah.
So
they are.
Apple's using OLED on the Apple Watch. I mean, they're not religiously opposed to it. It's just that they have certain, like, again, 3D Touch was dependent on LED.
But you have Force Touch on an Apple Watch, so maybe you can do
They're shooting. So tiny. All the stuff that we call Force Touch uses incredibly different technologies on the watch, on the Mac, and on the iPhone.
Okay. All right. Let's see.
That's why you don't have 3D Touch on the iPad, because it doesn't work on those super big screens yet. And the watch, I believe, is shooting horizontally, and that only works on tiny screens. So.
Okay. All right.
Stuff is hard, Leo.
Yeah. Apple's going to do a TV show about app developers. I've seen this headline on many sites, and I've never read farther because it sounds so boring.
Read further, Leo. The rest is arguably worse with Will I Am.
Yeah.
Oh, famed BlackBerry designer Will I Am. Famed iPhone case designer.
Who would watch a TV show about app designers? App developer.
App designer?
I would. I don't know if I'd watch it with Will. I mean, I don't
he's
want
actually,
to make it sound, but
it sounds like a great idea for a YouTube show.
Is it a reality show? What is it?
I think it's him interviewing people and talking to people. I will say that we've done some shows with Will I Am, and he's actually he's pretty interesting. I mean, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, the subject matter, I go, but if he gets comfortable, he's actually pretty geeky.
I could see us doing it or you doing it, but that would be have a completely different angle that isn't aimed at a mass market. It would be, you know, the insides of development. I mean, we do that all the time. But
in theory, I don't think any of this news has mentioned what the outlet would be for the show. But this is the sort of thing that you would think that if Apple wanted to create a show and just release it on their own Apple channels, or even just through, even God forbid, just through YouTube channels or any
Apple
other
Music.
Sort of public channels, it's a great medium for that sort of thing, because it's not dependent upon ratings. It really is just dependent on think space.
And I think that we're still seeing between the music stuff that they're working on and this is kind of a safe, you know, dipping their toe into this process of how they're going to do this and everything else. I do think this is the beginning of them doing a lot of original content. It's
why
just,
not? They have the money to do it.
It's crazy not to.
It drives Apple. Like if they do that, there was rumors that they were going to do a Dr. Dre. Maybe they're confirmed by now, a Dr. Dre TV show on Apple Music. And if this is also an Apple Music show, then it's very similar to HBO or Netflix, where you create programming to drive subscriptions.
And that would explain really Will matter. I Am, who's really best known as a musician.
Absolutely.
Yeah. A very good musician. I love his music.
Absolutely.
I've started to think about what if Apple doesn't want to do this as an Apple specific thing. What if they want to be producers, and they're okay with having making it an Apple exclusive for, let's say, the first 2 or 3 months, but then put it on Hulu, put it on Netflix. Netflix is a huge player right now. They are buying documentaries. They are like a top tier buyer of documentaries right now. They are the market that these people want to get into. I still don't know the answer to the question of which sort of non-musician filmmaker or TV producer is thinking, I hope we become an Apple exclusive, because that's where all the audience is. That's where all the money is, because that's not where any of the money is or any of the audience is right now. But this sort of thing would certainly fit in with that. And if they were to simply say, we're going to produce shows that we think we'd like to produce, that sort of fly our flag, just like the Apple Store flies the Apple flag in malls and corners of the street, where other people 10 years ago might not have been Apple people might not have been hanging out. Maybe this is a way to sort of extend the Apple brand or the Apple way of thinking to the screens that people have to be looking at the time, even if it's hooked up to a Roku box.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and predict there'll be a lot of shows about the Cayman Islands and Ireland produced in the Cayman Islands and Ireland. And it's just going to be a whole renaissance of filmmaking in the Cayman Islands and Ireland. I'm going to predict that.
How about how to move to the Cayman Islands?
Joss Whedon has no obligations right now. Apple has hundreds of billions of dollars.
Right.
Let's put those two things together.
Right. Absolutely. All right, let's take a break and get your picks ready, gentlemen, and then we're going to cut into a pretty fine-looking cake.
Yum.
Ooh.
I've been smelling it all during the show. And we'll turn the Ozo back on.
Yes.
Maybe. It's up to you.
Yes.
We've already got 24 hours of rendering in the can.
I got a bunch of computers.
Leo's Mac Pro is free.
Yeah, you can use my Mac Pro. No, it's busy running 3 Minecraft instances, a mail server, a wiki. I actually spent $20. Actually, maybe that. Okay, I got a pick.
And a home theater.
I got a pick. No, I don't use it for my home theater. I use an Xbox One for my home theater. Our show today brought to you by magazines? Well, not your grandpa's magazines. I love magazines. I love magazines. There's great articles. The problem with magazines is, you know, there's one or two articles in every New Yorker, every Esquire, every Vanity Fair, every Rolling Stone. every time, but I don't want to subscribe to all those magazines, and I certainly don't want to buy an issue, one issue on the newsstand. That would be hundreds of dollars a month. Well, for the cost of a couple of issues on the newsstand a month, you can have every magazine. You can have all of them with Texture. Texture is like Netflix for magazines. Now you can binge read instead of binge watch the greatest magazines. They have the full magazine is in your Texture app on your iPad or your iPhone. You can start the magazines you want to read every time they come out, and they'll automatically appear on your device. You have current issues, but you also have back issues, and you have bonus features you can't do in print, like video. With Texture, you get the magazines you know and love, plus exclusive features and video, magazines like Men's Health and Wired and Interview. You really got to try the free trial because you got to see all the magazines. It's so great. You'll find new stuff, too. I'm not going to buy or subscribe to Billboard, but, you know, that's actually quite fascinating to see what's going on in the music industry every week. I think it's great.
It's just great to be able to get. I mean, you know that I think we've talked about it before.
You're a magazine junkie. I know you are.
Magazines. And, but I just got to a point where I didn't want to carry around the paper. So this is the solution.
Bulging.
You
know?
Yeah. And there's just stuff you're not going to find on Flipboard, which is.
Look, they got wood. That's. Wood magazine.
Anyway, now we have a title.
Yeah.
So, there's so many of these good things that you're just not. It's great content.
National
you're
Geographic.
Not going to see it.
Sound and Vision's a great audiophile.
Yeah.
Magazine. I love looking at stereo equipment. I can't afford. It's so much fun. Shutterbug. here's the deal. If you go to texture.com/MacBreak, you can sign up for a free trial right now. You'll get instant entry to all the top magazines, including back issues, including bonus video content. And it's absolutely free. Texture.com/MacBreak. They even have like curation to make it easy, like an editorial team. It'll make it easy to find topics you're really interested in or deep dive into interviews and stories based on other interviews and stories you've read. I love it. Texture.com/MacBreak. Try it free right now. All right, you want to turn on the Ozo?
It's on.
It's time to immerse you. Alex Lindsay, your pick of the week this week is that big round ball. What's that thing coming out of the back?
So that is the battery and the memory. So what's coming out of the back there is...
Is that a dead spot then?
It's not really. So there is a little bit of a cavity behind it, that right behind it, which is actually kind of useful. You can put mics and all kinds of other stuff back there. But the each lens is 192 degrees. So it's actually, you know, closes in behind it pretty quickly. And this is the Nokia Ozo. It does run on a Mac, so it's good for MacBreak. You know, in case you're wondering, all the controls.
Okay. So you said you get SDI out of it. So
right. But, so it's
how would you get that into a Mac?
So you actually we can preview it, and I think that they can show it, but we can preview it with a regular SDI. Cable into a little mini recorder, a Blackmagic mini recorder.
Okay.
And so you can see it all there. And so we can preview it there from the Mac. We can shade the cameras. We can, make adjustments, change a lot of the things. So it's the control, is all done through that. The Mac, my laptop can actually sync up. There's a Wi-Fi inside of the camera so that I can't see all the feeds, but I can control the camera, start record, stop record, do all those things from a laptop. So it's pretty cool. And anyway, so it is, in my opinion, and again, we have a lot of rigs. we've been doing VR stuff. We've been doing 360 photos for 20 years. Video for the last 2 years, streaming for the last year and a half, this is the closest thing to just like a camera that you turn on and it works, you know? And so we're just testing it right now, but it's, I'm really excited about it. It is
$60,000.
You know, it's a production camera. Like this is a,
it's,
you know, this
spendy.
It seems like a lot. And again, what I said earlier is it's not how much something costs as much as it is how much.
It's 85.7 Alex's.
Right. Yeah. There you go. There's your little
comes
kit.
In a That's nice Pelican case.
It does
I like
have a
that.
Nice Pelican case. And you know you can run and gun with it. So what I mean by that is that you can take all this tethering that we have off, and it'll run for, I think, about 45 minutes. And so you can just put it on a tripod, put it on a jib, put it on something steady, you know. So again, with all the other cameras that we've been playing with, that takes some effort.
Yeah.
You know, you're either going to either always has to be connected, or you, you know, with a GoPro, you know, we use a lot of GoPros. We have lots of them. We have GoPro rigs. But there's lots of little SD cards, and you're pulling them all off and keeping track of them all. And, you know, this is just recording, and you pull it off, and you can then, you know, deal with it, and everything's synced up. And
I shouldn't
and so
slump
and so
while
so
you're talking, because people can still see me.
They can still, you can't get away from
oh,
it.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so.
I was picking my nose.
Yeah, so.
There's no privacy.
Yeah, so anyway, so the, it's an investment. This is a professional camera. This is not going to be.
But it's an investment. I think, you know, first of all, it's going to come down, and I really think this is kind of, in many ways, the future of our shows in particular, these kind of roundtable shows.
Yep.
I think it's a great way to watch.
Well, and we're designing, one of the things we're testing with this camera and with a couple other cameras is really testing building shows around the idea of VR.
Yes.
So that you feel like you can sit at the table around with us.
You could make a rap show about Alexander Hamilton or something. And then,
so great.
And then put it on the stage. I really would love to see a Broadway show where you're not in the audience looking through a proscenium arch at the performance, but you're sitting on the stage.
What?
This is the view. All right.
No, this is me making fun.
Oh, you loser. This is a fake view that has been created by our technical director, Jason Cleanthes. That would be, I mean, even theater would be really interesting.
Well,
right?
And I'm really excited about, and one of the things we want to start doing tests with cameras like this, is the idea of, when I always think of the Birdman, you know, where they have that kitchen scene. And, you know, you want to sit up there at the table and sit there and watch as if you were in. But the idea is how do we design the play around that? You know, like or take a play and convert it to this.
But
so
what can happen is now the idea of point of view is really changing, because normally a director and actors and everything in a movie or a TV show or even on a stage, although a stage is a little different, but they direct your attention. With this theater is nice because you can watch something else while it's going on. But I love the idea. We always thought it'd be really fun to do of all of our shows have a multi-camera kind of switcher that you could switch yourself.
Right.
But this would be even better because you can naturally look around.
Right.
And want to see Renee's reaction as Alex says something. You can you can look at Renee. There it is. There's the Birdman
scene. So I just always think this one would be interesting. And what you're really choosing at this point would be, where do you stand for that scene? And, you know, and then we put you somewhere else where
you
stand.
Yeah, you have to rethink it. And you might have things, you know, the Gear VR has a Cirque du Soleil performance.
Which I think
where,
is
isn't it
exciting.
Great? Yeah. And that's an example because there's stuff going on all around you. It's like a three-ring circus. And so what you look at determines what performance you're seeing. And each time you do it, you can do a different performance.
Well, and the other thing that we're thinking about is also how to layer this into a 360 experience that you might want to, rather than making it 2 hours long, we might want to make it and try to just direct you with sound or whatever. What if we are thinking about, you're watching this the first time this way, but you know that now maybe I should watch it looking over here, see how that affected this. Or you're literally can do it over and over and over again. So
much of the attention on VR is going towards gaming, and as the Oculus Rift comes out this week and people start getting it, and what you do with it is you play games. But I think really it's an interesting way to be immersed in a scene and be part of a scene.
It is, and I think the reason that it's for gaming right now is because that's the easy. I mean, it's easier, which is that you don't have to deal with all these cameras, and you don't have to deal with all of the layering and because it's still not perfect. Even with this camera, you're going to have little seams, and if someone gets too close from the back, you'll see that.
Here's my experience. Yes, for instance, on the Gear VR. You can see the screen door because you're so close to that screen, as good as the screen is. You can see the pixels, but you quickly lose sight of that because the experience is so engaging. And so I think that the flaws really kind of go to the background pretty darn quickly.
Well, and also some of the tests that we've seen some other folks working on as well that are some of our partners is, what if you're in there and then you want to bring out, you know, like I want more data. Like I'm watching. Right. We did some tests with PGA Tour and which we talked about at South by Southwest. And one of the things we looked at in the future is that I could have the rankings. I'm watching it, but I could go like this with a controller or whatever, and bring in the, you know, I can look at a heads up display on top of my streaming video and see where that golfer is and how many feet is going in front of them. And so there's a lot of things that I can add to it. It's not that I can just be in this experience. I can have all kinds of other experiences. I can even have my email or my SMS popping up in front of me while I'm watching in
the experience. It does have to make you rethink, though, things like television studios, which are really, or movie sets, which are very carefully designed to use the camera as a framing mechanism. There's an outs, you go right outside the camera frame, it's garbage.
Yeah.
And so we really can't. This set is actually a good example of something that's not that way. We really wanted to make it a 360 degree set, but most TV studios are, you know. And
I'm just thinking about what happens if I move this camera a little bit that way or a little bit that way.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, and I also
that's bad news.
Well, and I also think that one of the things that's going to be interesting for this that we're looking at is also the idea of an extra for movies. So, you know, wouldn't it be really cool to see a Hobbit shot? You know, or a Matrix shot, or a Star Wars shot, where you're able to.
Well, that's going to happen.
And it's going to happen this year
soon.
And so what's going to happen is that when you're watching the DVD or you're watching the thing on iTunes, you're going to be able to go, oh, I want to something little pops up and you click on it, you know, like the White Rabbit in the old Matrix,
right?
And you suddenly pop into what it looked like when they were shooting it. You know that type of thing is. You know, I would love to see the VR applied to the White Rabbit tour in the Matrix. If no one's seen the White Rabbit tour. I would suggest it.
You know what's also the case is that gamers are already used to this, because when you're playing a first-person shooter, you do control the camera. You can look or Minecraft for that matter. You can look over your back or behind you. You can look all around. So we're already in an immersive 360-degree world, much like our normal world. This is an easy. I think this is easy to make this next step. Well, thank you for making this possible and bringing along the Ozo from Nokia. And it's a pick, but you can't get it yet, right? I mean,
you can. They are on sale. You can get one. They just went on sale, I think, last week. So they're shiny and brand new.
They're selling like Teslas.
A lot of people that are buying them right now are rental companies. You know, some production companies and a lot of rental companies.
But see, that's a good idea. You could go to somebody like B&H and say, I'd like to rent the Ozo for a day.
Maybe not B&H, but somebody definitely like high-end rental companies that, you know, that are getting Hollywoods. I mean, I was talking to somebody who bought one and then they got three. Because they were already paid the first one off.
Well.
You know, because right now everyone wants to try it and they'll spend $1,000 a day to give it a shot.
Right. The Ozo from Nokia, a great pick. You've outdone yourself, my friend.
I think that's my record.
I think it is the records. 85.7 Alex's.
Yes.
Andy Inoko, your pick of the week.
Maybe this is one Inoko because this is free. It costs you nothing. Google's Nic collection, which is a fantastic collection of photo plugins, is now free. They bought this company that had this amazing collection of professional photo filters that works with Adobe Photoshop, Adobe Lightroom, and anything else that works with Adobe plugins. When it was an independent company, it cost $500. When they acquired the company, they charged $150 for it. And last week they decided, okay, screw it. It's now free to download. It's a 500 megabyte download. You get the complete collection of these seven different plugins. And they're all really fantastic. They're not make your beautiful wedding photo look like it was shot with a Polaroid camera and then dumped on by your dog. It really is. So much of this is something I was doing with one of my Yosemite pictures. This is their Silver FX Pro. I was actually in Lightroom and then in Photoshop trying to get exactly that effect that's half dome. And I wanted to get like that lighter section look really, really light. And I wanted the darker sections really, really dark. And I couldn't just by twiddling knobs in either of these two apps get it done. Then I remember that this thing was free. I downloaded, installed it, and about 10 seconds later, mostly by picking out of a lineup one of the 12 samples that it generated for me and then tweaking it, it gave me exactly the results I want. And this is actually, as I'm trying to get better at photography, you learn that a lot of what you think is, well, the reason why that person got that effect is because they're a genius using some of the best equipment, and some of it is the reason why there's haze and note your photo is a little bit hazy and there isn't a whole lot of sharpness is because you didn't know the technique for removing the haze and adding sharpness to it, and these plugins will let you sort of add that sort of thing in without having to take 2 years for the Photoshop lessons. So it's free. It'll just cost you half a gigabyte of storage, and boy is it worth it. The only downside is that there is now a lot of speculation. Well, if Google's giving this away for free, maybe they don't care about it anymore. And the press the blog post that they released alongside this mentions things like, well, now that we're putting most of our attention into these other photo products, we decided to make these tools free, which indicates that if you're waiting for an update to any of these anytime soon, you'll be waiting an awfully long
time. Buy them anyway. Yeah,
free. And sorry, I've used all of them. There's an HDR tool. There's a
SilverFX is the single best monochrome plugin ever. I mean, it's the one everybody uses. It's incredible.
I'm using it, of course, with a really nice camera. But I'm getting a much better appreciation for how useful these things are on halfway decent phone cameras. Yeah. Because if your new iPhone takes really, really good 12 megapixel pictures, but the only complaint that you have is that, well, of course, in low light, it's a little bit noisy. Well, here's a filter that will remove that noise. And you're thinking, oh, but I just wish that I zoomed in a little bit, but now it looks a little bit blurry. Well, this will reduce that, and this will add the tonality that is missing from a really tiny image sensor camera. Really, I've been throwing my Nexus 5X photos at this, and almost any complaint that I have about the photos I've been taking are mostly negated when I start applying these third-party filters. And for a free package, it's just a no-brainer.
I think the hardest pressure it puts on is people who sell these kind of things. This will do most of what you need to do for free.
I'm thrilled, and I paid $300 for it.
So, I did too,
and I'm thrilled to see it for free now. When they bought Nick, they also got Snapseed, which they've been giving away, and that's the one they've been updating. And actually is in a phenomenal iPhone and Android.
My guess is, what they're going to do is keep on using the technologies that were in all of those plugins in future product without dealing with the individual apps, which would be very googly.
Can I say bravo to Google for Apple has bought a lot of apps, and then because they want the people or they want the technology, and then the app itself goes away. Bravo to them for after charging $150 for it for years, deciding that, you know what, maybe there are people who would like to use HyperCard for something. We don't know what it's useful for, but instead of just throwing it away, we're just going to start making it free. If you want it, here it is, download it. So it'd be nice if Apple had that kind of attitude about a lot of their other apps, as difficult as it is, I know, to keep these things up to date for modern iOS and macOS.
N-I-K is how you spell it. Nick Software, and what is it, google.com/Nick, probably, huh?
Google.com/Nick Collection, N-I-K-C-O-L-L-E-C-T-I-O-N.
Good pick. Really good choice. Renee Ritchie, your pick of the week.
You know what it is, Leo. Apple found a way to get me to buy more watch bands. So this
How
is
many
the
is
black,
this total?
It must be 20-something. This is the black Milanese. It's got the same diamond-like coating as the black Link bracelet, and it looks really good. It looks like Game of Thrones chainmail. Mm. It's hard to show on this camera, but they also released these really nice – like the sports bands are great, but after a while, a sports band is a sports band, which shows just how if you scratch my surface, you find more surface. But they have these great new woven nylon bands, and they come in a variety of colors. They even have colored lugs on them, and they're the same price as the sports band. They're like $50. There's white. There's black. There's yellow, and they're just really bright, really light. They're not waterproof like the floor elastomer sports bands, but they're water resistant. So if you splash them, it's not a big deal. But they really give a nice sort of, there's a dew tone to them. There's some texture. There's some color to them. And they work really nice. I've bought, I think, 4 of them so far. I only brought 2 of them with me today. But it's just another nice way to change up the watch. And it's so easy to do that I was changing it almost daily for the last week.
And these are less expensive, aren't they?
They're $50.
Yeah.
And they dropped the price of the Apple Watch too. The Apple Watch Sport, at least, they dropped the price. So if you've been interested in an Apple Watch, it's cheaper than ever to get into it. And it comes with these bands now. You can get pairings with these bands, which is really nice.
I guess I should get one of these nylon bands.
Yeah, try like for exercise too. Like I was.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. I didn't want the rubber one, so I thought maybe the nylon would be a little better.
I'm still stuck. And they breathe really nicely.
I haven't found anything else I wanted.
Yeah,
Next time I'm at Comic Con, I'm gonna hand someone a picture of you and commission like a painting of you as Sean Connery and Zardoz. Only you're wearing. They're all made out
watch
of like
bandoliers.
Watch I feel as though you can actually do that. You have enough bands right now, Renee.
Hold, I speak. I have all my watch bands, and I'm wearing them as a robe. Perfect.
Perfect. My pick is actually something that, we've known about for a long time. Remember, Apple killed the server version of OS X some years ago. I'm running my Mac Pro as a server with just regular OS X, and it's running just fine. But I went online and I saw, oh, wait a minute, they're selling OS X server for $20 on the app store. And it is, look, it's you. Apple, the Mac comes with all the stuff you need to run a server, and it's easy enough if it doesn't to use Brew or Mac ports or something to install it. But what this gives you is a very easy way to start and stop services. It of course, adds all of the Apache and PHP and all the things you need to run a website. It comes with a built-in website and wiki. It's very easy to use VPN, XSAN4, and the control panel is very easy to control. And actually, this is a pretty good deal for $20.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was happy I bought it. It made it a lot easier for me to maintain and run my server, do the backups I need. And I'm now going to put more services on that thing because I've actually got a pretty solid server running out of my house. Now I can, you can put a mail server, mail server comes with it. You can do all sorts of stuff. Time Machine backup. You can use it as a calendar or contacts server. I love the wiki. I'm a big wiki fan, and having a nice wiki available, it makes it very easy to do, have shared notes and things.
And we love running server on little minis. Yes.
Right.
Minis. Those are great.
Right. Pretty impressive deal for $20. A lot of one-star reviews. I'm not sure why. I'm not sure what people don't like about it.
I think there was an error in one of the reviews.
It was buggy, Apex. Maybe. And,
I think so, yeah.
But I have not had a problem at all. It's been very reliable. So I thought I'd mention it. Maybe you didn't know about that. $20 on the Mac App Store. Well, this has been a great 500th episode. I want to thank all of you for being here. Alex Lindsay, who
couldn't miss it,
here on episode one and most of the episodes in between. Andy Inako has been with us for 10 years as well. Has it been 10? It must have been.
Less than that, I think.
Yeah.
Probably about 8. Yeah.
Yeah.
8 or 9.
I should have called Merlin and Scott and gotten them back on. I'll call them. We'll get them.
501.
501.
More cake for us. Oh, yes. Wait. I don't get cake either.
More cake for us.
I don't know.
Right. Actually, more cake for me and Alex.
Eat for us, Leo.
I'll eat for all of you. I'm eating for 8 now. I'm Rene Ritchie from iMore.com. Really, the best panel of all panels. I mean, just the best, smartest, most interesting people. Talking about the Apple today. So I'm really glad you're
here. The most fun 2 hours I have every single week.
Yeah, I know.
I don't like to miss a show because I just enjoy talking to you guys for 2 hours.
Same here.
Thanks for joining us, everybody. We do the show 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern, 1800 UTC, every Tuesday at live.twit.tv or twit.tv/live. And you can be in the chat room at irc.twit.tv and play along the home version of our game. We also make on-demand audio and video of all of our shows available on our website. In this case, twit.tv/MBW. You can find it on every podcatcher out there, one of the top shows still to this day. We've been around long enough to have gained a pretty big audience. You can also find us on the free Twit apps and the paid Twit apps, all of which are created by our wonderful developers. Not by us, but our wonderful developers on every platform. So thank you. Find a Twit app. Subscribe to the show and be back here next week. But meanwhile, back to work for you because break time is over. Mm-hmm.